Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Odo Approach, a podcast created by medical students for medical students to teach you about all things otolaryngology. I'm your host, Allison, and I asked Dr. Edgecombe to speak to us here at The Odo Approach after he was a keynote speaker at the 2024 Canadian Society for Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery meeting in Montreal, where he educated Canadian otolaryngologists on the future of artificial intelligence, hereby referred to as AI, in the specialty. Dr. Philip Edgecombe is a radiology resident at the University of British Columbia with a PhD in biomedical engineering and a Bachelor of Applied Science in Engineering Physics. Alongside his residency, Dr. Edgecombe has an interest in exponential and disruptive technology. He helps healthcare organizations adopt the latest innovations to improve the efficiency of care and plan for the future of healthcare. He is also the co-founder of a startup company called Map Medicine. So thank you for joining us today. Dr. Edgecombe, could you please start by telling us a bit about yourself?
Well, Allison, it's great to chat again. Just before jumping into my introduction, I just wanted to say it's an honor to be on the podcast. It's great to connect with you again. It was nice to meet you at the CSOHNS conference, as well as lots of other medical students and residents and physicians in the world of ENT. It's going to be really fun to have a conversation with you about AI and healthcare.
Awesome. I'm happy to be speaking with you again, too. Thanks so much.
One of the themes that I'll touch on during our discussion is my strong belief that, especially when it comes to AI, it's imperative that we have young physicians and medical students that are engaging fully, because this is uncharted territory for everyone. And it's almost to the advantage of the naive medical student who doesn't know what can't be done to be working on this topic. So I guess that in a sense may represent a little bit of my own career journey, in that I started as an engineering physics student and decided to do the UBC MD PhD program because I really wanted to understand first and foremost the problems before trying to apply kind of technological solutions to improve the world of healthcare. And that is something that I worked on during my PhD. My focus there was surgical robotics for kidney cancer surgery. And in my residency, I've continued to have a research interest in biomedical engineering, as well as really trying to stay engaged and on top of the advances in the world of AI and healthcare. One of the things that I did during my PhD back in 2016 is I participated in this 10-week course called the Global Solutions Program at Singularity University. It was based on a NASA base in Palo Alto, and there were speakers there who spoke about exponential technologies, and that's in domains such as, you know, healthcare, but also transportation, computing, agriculture. And that experience really opened my eyes to how quickly technology is changing in a whole bunch of fields. And I think that has continued to inspire me to try to stay at the forefront of the opportunities for AI in healthcare.
Yeah, it can definitely be a bit intimidating for medical students to try to dive into this world of new technology. So it's really nice to hear from someone who's been there and who has taken that courageous leap into the unknown in the future. And I do understand that you've done that as part of your startup company called Map Medicine.
Map Medicine is a company that I've co-founded with Dr. Catherine Isaac, a plastic surgeon, and Tony Jang, an engineering student. We've called it Map Medicine because we are trying to provide a map of the patient's anatomy on the patient during the surgery so that the surgeon can see into the patient before they cut. And we're using the Apple Vision Pro headset that was released in the US in February of this year, in Canada in, I can't recall if it was June or July of this year. And the Apple Vision Pro headset gives us the ability to overlay preoperative imaging and segmented anatomy onto the patient. And so we're really excited about the opportunity to use this to augment the surgeon, to give them extra information, to help them find, you know, small little blood vessels associated with the flap, for example, or to help them put that incision in just the right place to be able to access the tumor. And we think that this extra information for the surgeon when they put on the Apple Vision Pro at particular points in the surgery will actually reduce operative time and complication rates. And so that has been a real joy for me to work on. And actually, at the CSOHS conference, I was there with, at that time, it was the MetaQuest 3 headset, and I must have had maybe 25 or 30 surgeons try on the headset. And it was really exciting for me to see the, I guess, the openness that the ENT surgeons had, the interest that they had. And I would say about half of them said, well, I'd like to have something like this in my operating room. So that was a great signal that we're building something that surgeons are going to use and that will help patient care.
So Dr. Edgecombe, when you say overlay the images, do you mean that you're looking through the vision goggles at the patient and their own anatomy is being overlain on themselves?
Yes. And the Apple Vision Pro goggles or the MetaQuest 3 goggles, the way they work is they have these little video cameras in the goggles that are taking a video of the real world. And then those are displayed to the surgeon on these wraparound glasses. And in the case of the Apple Vision Pro, it's at 4K resolution. And so you're watching potentially a video of the operative field, and you can see the patient. And then on top of that, since it's now a screen, we can put the CT scan, we can put a particular segmented anatomy, and we can place it with a fair amount of accuracy onto the patient so that, yes, you get to see the CT scan, quote unquote, overlaid onto the patient. And it's like you're finally getting to review the operative imaging, preoperative imaging in three-dimensional space. It's no longer only something that you could review in the computer screen in the corner of the operating room. So I'm really excited to continue to move this forward. And I'm hopeful that, say, in 5 or 10 years' time in surgical residency programs, it'll just be part of the accreditation, is that all residents have to have exposure to this technology because it's going to become more and more prevalent in surgery in the future.
Well, just hearing about this technology makes me excited to hopefully interact with it sometime in the future, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners are also feeling the same way.
I think you might have actually already interacted with it, if I recall you.
I did try on the glasses at the conference. It was really fun. I remember there was a whole lineup of students and physicians alike waiting to get their hands on those glasses to see what it was like. I mean, to me, it was my first ever exposure to like a goggle or a wraparound headset like that. And it felt very surreal to be able to try them on in such a relaxed and fun setting as the social that night of the conference.
If I remember correctly, it was a social in a converted Catholic church. Was that right?
It was a social in a converted Catholic church with circus performers hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah. So it was like very, it was like augmented reality of another kind. Because you wouldn't necessarily. Yeah.
It already felt like I was in an alternate universe when I was inside the church. And then I put on the goggles on top of that. And it was like, it was a lot.
The alternate universe and the alternate universe. Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, I loved getting to get feedback from yourself and others. And I was really glad that everyone was willing to just try on the glasses and imagine what that would look like for the future of surgery. I also have a bit of a funny personal story, which is on the first night of the conference, I had met Dr. Leitao, who's a pediatric otolaryngologist, really friendly guy who was very kind because I was a bit of an outsider, I guess. And he was happy to kind of introduce me. And I told him that the only other pediatric otolaryngologist that I knew was Dr. Kozak. And I said Dr. Kozak was a bit of a household name in my family because he had actually been the doctor that had looked after my brother for 30 years because my brother had some hearing concerns. We always looked forward to, or I would always hear about the appointments with Dr. Kozak. And he said, well, let me, you know, take you over here. And he's like, I present to you the one and only Dr. Kozak. And pretty fun for me to meet Dr. Kozak in person. And
you finally got to meet the legend you heard about at home.
Yeah, I had met him as a medical student, but this was fun to meet him again. And he remembers my brother because my brother was one of his first patients as a new staff physician. And now Dr. Kozak is an experienced experienced staff physician, but still full of energy and has lots of good jokes and to share. So that was the first night of the conference, and I certainly felt, you know, right at home after that, after a warm welcome from Dr. Darren Leitao, and then meeting the superstar doctor of my childhood, one degree removed, to being so good for my brother.
Yeah, the conference, I expected it to be educational, and it definitely was. And I learned so much and was really inspired by all the speakers I listened to. But I also got to meet so many amazing people in the field, and it was more of a more social than I thought it was going to be. And I really got to meet these people in both a professional and educational setting, as well as a more social and conversational setting as well.
Anyway, so it was really fun for me to get to know the kind of ENT community more in person, and to get the kind of feedback and interest that was quite nice.
So that map medicine, that is an example of some of the exponential technology you're involved in. Is this the same as disruptive technology?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the concept of exponential technology is highly interlinked with the concept of disruptive technology. The quintessential example of exponential technology is computational performance. And we've all experienced that in our lifetimes, in that the classic Moore's law predicts that the density of transistors on an integrated circuit doubles every 18 months to 2 years. And so then if you're taking exponential steps, that's 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and the technology improves, you know, dramatically in an exponential way. And when that happens, it has the opportunity to disrupt. You know, a few examples that I'm sure we're all familiar with is how Netflix and you know, disrupted the blockbuster model, or Uber disrupted the taxi model, and that was underpinned by exponential technology and computational power, internet streaming rates, our ability to do GPS mapping. Those exponential technologies did become disruptive as well.
Okay, so would I be right in saying that disruptive technology is almost the big major shifts we have in the way we do things?
Yes, I think it's, you know, a technology that potentially can disrupt significantly how we do things.
So what originally drew you to being involved in this disruptive technology in healthcare?
I mean, I think I trained as an engineer. So I was always fascinated by technology and physics. And it seemed to me like the most meaningful place to work, and I'm sure this is a realization shared by many of the listeners, is in medicine. And so I started my career with a goal to bring technological solutions to medicine, the quintessential bridging of the bench to bedside. But I guess mine might be the computer science lab to the bedside. And so by virtue of that, it's important to understand which technologies are going to be exponential, which are going to be disruptive. One of the, I would say, biggest proponents of the concept of exponential technology is this scientist, Dr. Kurzweil. And he was someone who was a pioneer in speech to text recognition in the 80s and 90s. And he was originally an entrepreneur, and he became a futurist because as an entrepreneur, he was always trying to anticipate where technology would be a 2 or 3 or 4 years in the future, such that he could start building businesses and designing tools that would perfectly intersect with the technology performance improvement curve, such that when he was finally ready to launch, the technology was there to support his product that would be able to, you know, actually work. And so I think that, you know, the combination of wanting to build solutions that work in healthcare naturally motivates a desire to understand technological trends and the evolution of technology.
Okay, very cool. Thanks for explaining all that. I guess one of the technology trends there's a lot of talk about, not only in the classroom, but in the media, is artificial intelligence. And I know that you are an expert in artificial intelligence, and I was just wondering if you could please review it for us and tell us a bit about what AI is.
Yes, I would love to. There's many definitions for AI, but I would say that artificial intelligence refers to the field of computer science dedicated to creating systems or machines capable of performing tasks that typically require human intelligence. And it's been the exponential growth of computational power, the exponential growth of our ability to store data that has enabled tremendous progress in AI. And some examples of AI at work and impressive AI breakthroughs in the last few years include things like the AlphaGo competition, where an AI was able to beat the best human at the game Go, which is like a very complicated game in terms of the number of moves. So it's kind of like chess plus plus. A related AI breakthrough was the development of AlphaFold, which was an AI program that predicted the protein structure based on just the amino acids. And what AlphaFold allowed us to do is go from 200,000 known protein structures to effectively 200 million, or all of the proteins in the known universe, now knowing what their protein structures are. And that's going to have all sorts of really transformative impacts in terms of drug development in the future. And then object image recognition has been also a great example of AI, where, you know, computers are able to identify objects in images at or beyond that of humans' abilities. And then I think the most obvious example that's probably front of mind on everybody has been the large language models that came out, you know, originally with ChatGPT, and have shown just phenomenal abilities in terms of being able to really understand language and allow us to interact with computers with just language. So those are all examples of, you know, significant artificial intelligence breakthroughs.
Yeah, one thing I find really interesting is how you defined artificial intelligence as systems or machines that can perform tasks that typically require human intelligence, but it just seems like the computers or machines or systems are going above and beyond what we do and doing it at such a faster rate. I can only imagine it's going to be having a huge impact on the medical world.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. I would also say there's a much simpler definition to AI, which can also be useful to keep in mind. And this one comes from Ajay Agarwal, who's a professor at the University of Toronto. And he actually wrote a book called Prediction Machines. And in that book, he really made the case that AI is just something that's good at making predictions. So an AI can predict a protein structure. An AI can predict what is the next move that's good to make and go. An AI can predict what is the right answer to a question. And so his perspective was, just think of AI as this incredibly powerful prediction machine. To your point, Allison, a lot of medicine is about prediction. And if you can predict what disease someone has or predict how they're going to do with a particular treatment, that's very significant and very important. If you can predict, you know, which patient most urgently needs a surgery, or predict which patient should have been discharged that hasn't. I mean, there's so many potential applications.
Yeah, well, it just seems like predicting is what physicians and other healthcare workers are trying to do every single day. So to think that we could have a technology that can help us with that is just very exciting.
I would just say we do a lot of predicting on a regular basis, but we also do a lot of judgment. And that is something which is still probably best done by humans, in that it's all very well to predict and diagnose that someone has some kind of neck cancer, but then it's up to them and their physician to decide what is the best treatment for them. You know, some people would rather surgery over radiation, or couldn't fathom the idea of having a dry mouth for 30 years. So there's inherently like a judgment aspect that comes in, which is uniquely human. And I think that's the real value that physicians will continue to bring to the table for many years.
It's really nice to hear, because I think a lot of physicians and medical students are worried about what their role will be in healthcare if AI is involved. But bringing the judgment into it kind of reminds us that although the systems and computers and machines can be very smart and efficient, there's something uniquely human about healthcare and the compassion and the understanding that comes with it that these systems aren't able to do just yet.
Yeah.
Do you have any examples of the impact AI has had in the medical world, like in the past few months?
Yeah, I think there's quite an exciting study that came out in April in Nature Medicine, And the study is called AI-enabled electrocardiography alert intervention and all-cause mortality, a pragmatic randomized clinical trial. So it's a bit of a mouthful, but up until April 2024, there'd been lots of studies of AI in hospitals. And most of those studies looked at endpoints like detection accuracy, maybe even discharge time, things like that. But this study that I just referenced was one of, if not the first example of a randomized control trial where they showed that the deployment of AI in a hospital actually reduced death, like reduced all-cause mortality. And specifically, this study was a randomized control trial with 16,000 patients at two hospitals in Taiwan. The intervention group had AI ECG assessment and alert system. So the physician was alerted if the AI thought there was a concerning finding on the ECG and then could proceed accordingly, oftentimes reassessing the patient and sometimes elevating their level of care. And what they found was that among the high-risk group patients, there was actually a 31% relative reduction of deaths at 90 days for all-cause mortality in the AI group. And that was pretty impressive.
Well, of course, and part of healthcare is doing anything we can to make someone's life better or prolong someone's life in a meaningful way. So if AI can help us do that, why wouldn't we want to adopt it?
Yeah, why wouldn't we want to adopt it? That's a very big question. How long do we have? We'll stop it there. But there's lots of things to consider about rolling out a new kind of technology and intelligence into a healthcare system.
Yeah, a whole debate that could probably take a couple more hours of podcasting. If we were to get more specific about AI in otolaryngology or surgery, what is the role of AI there?
There are two FDA-approved AI machine learning algorithms in the field of ENT. One is called VisionAir and FlowAir from this company called Pacific MD Biotech. And then there's another AIML-enabled medical device that Brain Lab has the approval for, and that's related to helping with surgical navigation and image-guided surgery. So there are two products that are available for purchase that are ultimately underpinned by AI in the field of ENT. But I guess the thing about surgery is yes, it's a tactical thing in that you're cutting and sewing, but it's also a very much a visual thing. And so there's lots of interesting opportunities for AI as like an image recognition tool in surgery. And someone who I've really learned a lot from and turned to as a real kind of thought leader in this space is Dr. Peter DeBakker. He's a friend and colleague of mine. He's actually a urology resident in Belgium, but he also is the surgical artificial lead for this research institute called the Orsi Academy. And so in our conversation, some of the areas that he's highlighted as AI being useful in surgery includes automatic smoke removal, so that it just kind of cleans up the view digitally if you're using a laparoscopic camera. AI can always be watching during a surgery. So for example, it can track when a needle goes out of frame, which is something to be avoided. It can potentially assess the quality of a needle or a suture bite, the quality and the consistency of one's grasp of a needle when they're picking it up with a surgical instrument. And so if you have this AI analysis running in the background at the end of one surgery or practice in the cadaver lab or whatever, the AI can actually generate a report card and it can say, this is how many bites were good. This is how many times you grabbed the suture properly or incorrectly. This is how many times the suture went out of frame. And it could even take you back to those moments in the surgery where it was working well or where it didn't. And I think that kind of always present coaching can really help with just the fundamental skills of surgery.
Totally. That's really cool. As physicians and surgeons, I think everyone is always trying to improve their technique and make everything more efficient and effective. So the idea that AI could play a role in this is exciting and really interesting. Something I definitely haven't thought of when I think of the role of AI in medicine.
Yeah. And you can go a step further. And this is something that Peter DeBakker and his team have been working on, which is to really identify in a very systematic way. And this starts with humans. The humans experts have to define in a surgery, okay, what are the common steps in a surgery? And for a radical prostatectomy, there could be 81 steps. And then within each of those steps, what are the operative errors that could occur? Well, you could accidentally cut the ureter at this point, or the aorta is nearby at this point. I don't know the specifics, but you can imagine what all those operative errors are. And then of those operative errors, what are critical errors? And then you can train an AI algorithm to potentially identify what step you are in the surgery and to be looking to see if those operative errors are occurring, or flagging to the user that there's a risk of these particular operative errors at that point. And the dream is that in the fullness of time, that you have such a rich data set of surgical outcomes with the surgical videos that you can really start to apply like data science to say, okay, well, there were a few mistakes that were made in the surgery. Did it affect the operative outcomes? And really get a very granular understanding of the moves and the steps in a surgery that really matter. And so that's also something that kind of intelligence can just always be running in the background and further informing surgical approaches.
Amazing. Thanks for going through all that with us. And I remember, Dr. Edgecombe, when we were talking before we started recording, you mentioned something about a eustachian tube balloon dilation, a way AI can shape otolaryngology. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I should say when I was at the CSOH&S conference, I really enjoyed connecting with Dr. Jennifer Su. She had a presentation there on AI and surgical skills, evaluation and application to otolaryngology training. So I think there are already otolaryngologists that are working on AI for surgical skill assessment and training. And so that's really exciting that there is that expertise and interest within Canada. As it relates to that question about eustachian tube dilation, that's another potential application for AI in surgery. There was a paper that recently came out that was published by a friend of mine and recent UBC ENT resident grad. His name's Dr. Amin Emanian, and he published a paper in otolaryngology head and neck surgery, and the title was A Deep Learning Framework for Analysis of the Eustachian Tube and the Internal Carotid Artery. So the question is, well, why does that matter? And what Amin explored was automatic segmentation of these two structures. Because when a surgeon is doing a eustachian tube balloon dilation, there's always a risk that they could damage the internal carotid artery. And just if you kind of over-dilate and the internal carotid artery is near the eustachian tube, there is a risk, small risk of a significant complication there. And so what he proposed was using deep learning to automatically segment these structures and calculate the distance between them. And so one can imagine in the future, you, let's say Allison, as a future ENT surgeon going into a case for eustachian tube dilation, balloon dilation, and not only can you review the preoperative imaging and the radiologist report, but you also have this automatically generated metric, which is this is the distance from the eustachian tube to the internal carotid artery. And that's just always running in the background based on segmentation of those structures.
Very cool. So all of this research and innovation done by Canadian physicians and Canadian medical student graduates is really exciting, but I think it can be a little daunting for current medical students who are worried about transitioning to practice and transitioning into this exciting time of AI innovation. I was wondering if you had any advice for people like myself who may be a bit daunted by this new exciting world of AI that will be coming into the healthcare system in the future. And now, I guess, already, as you spoke about.
I mean, it's a great question. There's a lot to learn in the conventional world of medicine. Just getting through clerkship is an accomplishment in and of itself. And it's important at all stages of training to make sure that first and foremost, you're a competent medical student or resident or physician and able to achieve the standard of care that you're expected to be able to do. But above and beyond that, I believe that there are lots of medical students and residents that can find extra meaning and purpose and impact in their career by exploring the world of research and especially thinking about opportunities for the application of AI in healthcare. And I'd say we're all learning together. you know, ChatGPT only came out, you know, within the last few years. And so there is no one who's necessarily an expert on it. And so medical students are just as well placed as an attending with 30 years of experience to be diving in, maybe even better placed and thinking about where these new AI tools could be applied in healthcare.
That's really cool. And it's inspiring to know that even a lot of medical students like myself are only so far into their career in education. It's nice to know that we can still get involved in this exciting area of innovation. And I think you mentioned before that you knew some current students or residents that are already involved in AI research.
Yeah, I think it's important to highlight that there's already lots of medical students that are diving full on into this world of AI research. I'd highlight two here. One is Eddie Guo. He developed OSCE-GPT, which you can go to just by OSCE-GPT.com. And effectively, his thought process was, can I just create a bunch of OSCE scenarios, put it through ChatGPT, and ask it for feedback, both on the medical diagnostic accuracy, but also on, you know, the way I was conversing with the simulated patient. And he has built out a pretty impressive OSCE curriculum. So you can go and practice OSCEs in all sorts of subspecialties on that website. And so he's done that as a medical student and has been the co-lead on that project.
And what an exciting thing for medical students like myself and others that are listening, that now we have this resource that we can go to and help us study for our exams. Are there any other students besides Eddie?
Daniel Shivani is a UBC medical student. I know him well because we're at UBC and we have this shared interest in entrepreneurship innovation. He actually came out to my beach birthday celebration just yesterday. So we were catching up about his startup, which is it's called Quas AI, Quas AI. And it's an AI scribe built around ChatGPT. And so it's a product which will listen in to a patient encounter and provide an appropriate summary of that encounter. It generates kind of a soap note on the fly. My girlfriend is a vet, and she actually tried using it in her practice and was very impressed with it. And I think there's lots of physicians in BC that are now using it, and Daniel is rolling it out more broadly across Canada. You know, he had some background in computer science, not an actual degree, but an interest in coding. And when ChatGPT came out, he just started to work with ChatGPT to do the prompt engineering on the backside, which is effectively, what is the question? How do you set it up such that ChatGPT does a good job at writing a note? What is the prompt that you need to give it? You know, you need to ask that it's a, you know, pretend that you are a experienced physician interviewing a patient. In the summary, don't mention yourself, as in the AI chatbot, and write a note that a expert physician would write after doing this interview or something like that. And by the way, you might benefit by reviewing this chapter on these common ENT conditions before you do this summary, because that might be helpful for you. So that's what's running in the back end. And Daniel's done the work to address the legal considerations around storing and sending some of the information down to the ChatGPT servers. An OpenAI, they delete all of the recordings within a month. And so he's built a real product that physicians are using every day. And I believe you could take that and do that over and over again in all sorts of different specialties or in the realm of patient education about certain medical conditions. The sky's really the limit.
That's really exciting, especially to hear about people around the same place in their education as myself and most of our listeners. So thank you so much for sharing those examples with us. Is there anything else we didn't talk about yet that you would like to mention to our listeners?
Well, I think, you know, we've talked about large language models vis-a-vis kind of understanding language. We've talked about image recognition for detecting, were you holding the surgical needle correctly? What stage of the surgery are you in? But really what has really just come on the scene in the last year is this concept of multimodal AI. So can you build an AI that not only listens, but also watches and then puts that information together? We do that all the time in that, say, we're walking through the city, we're listening and looking at the road, hopefully before we cross it, as long as we don't have our noise canceling AirPods. But assuming you don't have those, like, we are inherently multimodal. When we're walking down the street, we're listening and watching for cars. When we're talking to a friend, we're listening for what they're saying, the tone of their voice, their facial expression. When we're operating or doing a biopsy, you know, we're using our sensory input as well with our hands. And so the question is, can you create multimodal generative AI applications, which is able to make predictions based on these multimodal inputs, both visual and audio? The answer is seemingly yes. As of just May 14th, 2024, Google came out with Gemini 1.5 Flash, which is one of the leading multimodal generative AI neural nets. And it's just phenomenal, the size of the data that it can take in. So you can draw a 1 hour video into Gemini Flash and ask it to analyze it. And as it related to my talk at the CSOHNS, I wanted to make sure that I was flagging to the ENT community what are some of the most recent advances in AI. And I was able to team up with a medical student at UBC who's interested in END. His name's Norbert. And to do this video analysis where he found a video just on YouTube from Mayo Clinic, which was a level 2 to 4 select neck dissection, but it also had narration from the surgeon. And the surgeon would talk about the importance of identifying the accessory nerve, it would describe the accessory nerve. And we just opened a free Gemini 1.5 account, and we took this 24-minute video and just dropped it onto this multimodal AI, and then just started asking it questions, having a conversation. And so we wanted to see, how did it do if we just gave it the audio, you know, a description of the surgery, or if we gave it just the video, because we wanted to try to figure out how much information it was taking out of the narration of the surgery versus the video of the surgery itself. When it came to identifying the accessory nerve, when we gave it the video and the audio, it was able to say the accessory nerve has shown up at minute 12 or whatever it was. But that's because it was listening. The narrator said, okay, the accessory nerve is now in view. And when we gave it just the video, it couldn't come up with the time that the accessory nerve had come into view. So that demonstrates it didn't quite have the anatomical or, you know, visual understanding on its own to make sense of when the accessory nerve occurred. When we asked it to identify bleeding, it could do it with or without the audio. And then we even gave it kind of some second order questions, like, can you identify a time where there'd be a higher risk of damage to the thoracic duct? And the narrator never mentioned thoracic duct, but it did mention other anatomical structures that are near the thoracic duct. So the AI was able to say, okay, look, at minute, you know, 10, there's these other anatomical structures that are near the thoracic duct, so it's probably at high risk of injury. So it was able to kind of use some second order reasoning. But again, when you took out the audio and just gave it the video, it couldn't make sense of the anatomical structures, let alone when the thoracic duct was in view. So it just gives you an idea of how easy it is to do research, because this multimodal tool really only became available to the public in the last few months. And so the questions we were asking were very novel. We're probably some of the first people in the world to say, okay, how does this multimodal generative AI tool do when applied to head and neck surgeries? And so I'm hopeful that there'll be people listening to the interview today who are already having those gears grind in their mind and thinking about, okay, well, how else could we use this in medicine? Now that we have AIs that can take both image and audio together, where is that going to be useful?
Yes, and I remember at the conference listening to yourself and Norbert talk about this technology, how exciting it was for me. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, just to share a bit for every student interested in otolaryngology or any medical student in general to learn about all these exciting innovations we have. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to share all this information with us.
Well, Allison, it's a great pleasure to do so. I certainly was glad to have to met you and many of the other students that are in the ENT community. I guess it was a couple months ago now at CSOHNS. And I'm fundamentally an optimist and hopeful about the advances that we're going to be able to bring and what our generation will be able to do in terms of improving healthcare, and I'm sure that kind of the strategic deployment of AI is going to be critical to the improvements that we'll make.